Hello everyone and welcome back to the Weekend Splurge. This week I'm joined by the remarkable Dr. Gamini Gunatilakar. This episode was filmed on October 7th and as you're about to see slash hear, it's quite a special day. Join us as we discuss about his life as a surgeon during wartime, the importance of experience and how it's time for change in the Sri Lanka medical system. I'll include timestamps in the description so you're free to skip around, as well as a link to his website. And without further ado, enjoy.
Yeah.
Hi, sir.
Wait, pardon me. At the end of it, can you ask something about my website too?
Sure.
Because we are going to link it to
We can talk about it from the beginning if you prefer.
Then I want to attract more people to this site.
Yeah.
So now, after you record what happens?
Now, thing is, it's already recording. Because you were talking from the beginning, right?
Recording, which?
So that's
from the
why
time you came.
No, I forgot. So when I got about here, that's why I quickly got on my phone. So the point is, there is no beginning, middle or end. It's just a whole, whatever you
just
want.
Just talking,
it to be.
Just talking. You can ask me anything you like.
So, sir, how was your day? Let's start with that. How was your birthday? Well, people don't know. We should tell everyone first, shouldn't we? What's so special?
It's actually my birthday, but there's nothing special because of the current situation in the country.
Yeah.
And anyway, my son
I thought your family would come.
Son and family and my daughter and husband, Shimali and Duti, they'll be coming for dinner.
Oh, right. Okay.
But my other son is in England.
Right.
With his wife.
How's
things
in England now?
Situation in England is bad in certain areas,
mm-hmm.
like Manchester and Midlands.
Right.
But they are living in Sussex, so it's not so bad.
Right.
But anyway, they will be able to come here today or maybe even Christmas.
Right.
Because of the current situation.
So bad. At least we are
talking. So we are having some dinner. You can join us.
No, it's fine, sir. I wouldn't want to intrude. That's why I was worried. That's why I asked.
That's all, because we can't go out. No, we don't want to go out today with all this coronavirus problems. And from morning, so many calls have been coming. And wishes on WhatsApp and email and now, even now.
I sent at 2 in the morning or something, didn't
that
I?
That could have been the first one I got, but I was sleeping.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, sir.
If I knew that you were sending me a message at 1 o'clock in the morning, I would have been up.
No, sir, I had a so I told you I go for those ERPM classes.
Yeah.
They had there was a restream, so it's all done online, right? So it's all high tech, it's all fancy now.
All online?
Online. So what happens is, the actual class, they film it. And then the ones that miss it, I miss the last class. So they restream it on an app. They've created an app just for those classes. And they had a streaming from 9 to 2 in the morning.
So that is for how many students?
So the actual class has about 100 odd, all coming online. But like the other classes I've been to, it reaches more than 600. And that can all be facilitated.
So you don't have to go to that hall now.
Exactly. Anyway, can't.
This is only a theory.
Theory.
And do they tell you how to answer questions?
Yes.
In multiple choice?
So those classes, so this is just the basics. So, for example, what I'm going for now is anatomy of thorax, abdomen and pelvis. Like the main points. So it's not like you go to university and they are teaching you. It's like what will the most clinically relevant things that doctor teaches us. So
I think that is what is needed in medical college as well.
Mm-hmm. Like there's so much of information.
You know, when I was in medical college for 5 years, we learned such a lot of things which become irrelevant when you start practicing, especially things like anatomy, where you learn, you know, the smallest branches of a main blood vessel, which are not relevant, but still they want to teach us. Maybe to complete that subject, we have a better knowledge. It applies to all the subjects. The paramedical, you know, not the clinical subjects like surgery, medicine, chin and nobs. where you have to be thorough with what you are doing because you are dealing with patients.
That was one of my main concerns. Like, I went for an anatomy class, and I was, because how thorough it was, I was like, do we really need to know all of this? Like, when it comes to the actual clinical side of it?
No, actually, when I started my medical career in 1968, we even had to dissect bodies.
Right.
You know, there were cadavers, these are unclaimed bodies, brought from hospitals and kept in the, what is called the anatomy. They had large containers filled with formalin. They, at that time, they used formalin to preserve the dead bodies.
Yeah.
And the bodies are taken out, kept on a table, and we have a group of about 10 students in one group dissecting different regions of the body.
Right.
And then we had the book called Cunningham.
Right.
For different parts of the body, and we look at that and dissect. And then at the, once we finish, say, upper limb, we have a viva, where we ask questions about the different muscles, blood vessels, nerves. Then there is a separate viva for bones. We have to be thorough with the bones and the joints, and how the nerve is related to the bone, and how the blood vessel is related to the bone. Those are actually important.
Right.
Because if you have a fracture in your bone in the upper arm, the humerus, sometimes you can damage the blood vessel.
Right. Yeah.
So when you're doing clinical medicine or surgery, you should know exactly what fracture will cause damage to a blood vessel. And if that is so, you have to make sure that that damaged blood vessel is repaired within 6 hours. Otherwise you'll end up with gangrene.
Right.
Similarly, you must know that certain fractures can damage nerves. So if you get a damage to a nerve, then you end up with a paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
You must find out whether this is a permanent damage or something that will recover with time.
Right.
So those are the relevant things that are important. Similarly, when you go to the chest and the abdomen, that was a, as a surgeon, I must tell you that we should have a good knowledge of anatomy.
Yeah.
A surgeon should have a good knowledge of anatomy and physiology and pathology. Those are the three main subjects that we are concerned with.
As a surgeon.
Yeah, because when you are doing operations, you must know where exactly to make that incision.
Right.
Otherwise, you can cut some important organ.
Yeah.
Then you must know body function, because certain, some diseases like, say, patient having intestinal obstruction will affect your body fluid balance. There will be loss of electrolytes, you know, loss of sodium, potassium, chloride. So you must know physiology. And then you must know pathology very well, because it is pathology that of an organ that sends the patient to the surgeon. Like a cancer or some benign lump. So we must know exactly where do this occur, what type of problems you can encounter with these lesions. So I think for a surgeon, those three subjects are very important. That is why when you are studying for your surgery exam, the part one is consists of these three subjects.
Yeah.
Anatomy, physiology and pathology. After that only you concentrate on surgery.
Right.
And depending on what specialty you want to progressing.
Right. So those little things you learn are what's actually important, right? So that's what I feel like medicine is very content heavy when you go to university, but you only figure out what's actually important once you start practicing.
Yes. So anyway, it's good to know the subject thoroughly, because all the medical students who enter the medical faculty are not going to be clinicians. Some are going to join the faculty of medicine, and they will be teachers in medicine in different fields. Like some may be in the anatomy department, some will join the physiology, some will go to the clinical departments.
Right.
So it's very difficult for them in the faculty to identify at that stage. Because you know, I had decided to be a surgeon from the day I left medical my school. St.
Joseph's
College, yes.
Okay.
I got interested in surgery at the time I was dissecting animals.
Right.
For my A-level exam.
Yeah, you mentioned, yeah.
Because at that time one part of the exam was dissection of these different types of animals.
Yeah.
Starting
frogs
from
and
frogs, earthworms, cockroaches, then rats, frogs and sharks.
Right.
So you have to practice before the exam in school.
Mm-hmm.
Someone will supervise you. Then when you, at that stage actually there were two parts to the exam.
Mm-hmm.
Say, first part is the theory.
Yeah.
Once you pass, you are called for a practical exam and that is held at the Faculty of Medicine in the University, Colombo in Thurston Road. Unless you pass both, you cannot get through the A-level.
Right.
So they will say, give a rat and say, dissect the cardiovascular system of the rat. So you must know how to show the heart and the main blood vessels, you know, going to different regions of the body. So that is how we have to face the exam.
Right.
So when we were doing these dissections, I thought, I want to be a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked towards that end. I got interested more once when I was doing my internship appointment in Colombo. At that time, in the surgical ward, there was only two house officers and a SHO.
Mm-hmm.
So we also got some surgical experience.
Right.
You know, doing small things like suturing and doing some small operations. So my interest grew and then I sat for my, at that time we didn't have local exams. So we had to do the English exam.
Right.
And the part one was conducted in Sri Lanka, second part we had to go to UK.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we, what was called FRCS part one.
Mm.
And the examiners come from England to conduct the exam here. So we sit for the exam after your internship.
Mm-hmm.
So during my internship, I was studying for this exam.
Mm-hmm.
I finished my internship in October and I sat for the part one in January, you know, the next year. So I was able to get through that exam. But to do my second part, I had to go to UK.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not go immediately because at that time there was a regulation by the government of Sri Lanka that we have compulsory service of 5 years.
Mm.
So I got stuck for 5 years. I could go
to finish it.
Finish my exams only after 5 years. So that delayed my qualification a bit. Others have they gone earlier. Anyway, went to UK, we had to do some appointments there while working. They say that you have to do certain amount of surgical appointments, trauma, 6 months, orthopedics, like that. After that only we can sit for the exam. So after I sat for the exam, I worked for another year in England and at the end of 3 years, I decided to return to my country. Work as a surgeon.
Mm. So you worked during, I remember reading the most recent one, right? The, what was the name? You sent it to me.
Treating war casualties.
Right.
Yes.
That I was really curious to ask you.
Yes.
How was it working in those days?
No, actually in that story I started by saying then as a medical student or as a surgeon. We were never exposed to this type of war injuries. And we were never taught the principles of managing war injuries. Because we studied medicine during a peaceful time in our country. And even in England, although, you know, in England when I was there, they had the Northern Ireland violence, terrorism in Northern Ireland.
Right.
Which was also a terrorist type of problem.
This was around
80s.
Right,
early 80s.
It was the early 80s.
They had a terrorist war in Northern Ireland. They were also asking for separation. So there were incidents like bomb explosions in certain places, like then sudden attacks, similar to what we faced in our northeast.
Right.
But no one taught us how to manage these patients. So actually, when I went to Polonnaruwa, I never expected to face these problems.
Mm.
And never expected to bathe there for 6 years and 4 months.
Right. 6 years, 4 months.
That's actually a record. No surgeon has worked in that part of the country for such a long time.
Okay.
And one surgeon.
Respect.
One surgeon to treat the population of 260,000 people. That means the entire Polonnaruwa district.
Mm.
And added to that was, at that time we had the Madurai project, which is a Mahavali diversion scheme.
Mm.
And that brought in workers to that project.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, any casualty from that region also came to the same hospital.
One surgeon.
Then I have documented all this in my stories.
Right.
When I went there, actually there were no junior doctors because Sri Lankan doctors did not want to come and work in Polonnaruwa. So initially I had no junior doctors, no anesthetists. So I did the work of junior doctors as well as anesthetists.
Mm.
So all these have been documented in my stories.
Yeah.
I started my stories from the beginning.
Yeah,
from the day I went to Polonnaruwa, the facilities I had, how I adapted to the situation, how I faced challenges, and then gradually improved the place by getting, you know, help from various sources. You know, there were a lot of private agencies, and even the Madurai project has been done by foreign agencies.
Mm.
So they also came in and helped. Then there were social clubs like Lions Club. All of these people came to help because they knew that the surgeon there was interested in working for the people.
Mm.
So there was a very good response from the government, you know, officers like the, at that time there was a government agent. Then the army came in and helped, the police, the government departments, we were all working together as a team. And then we had to face the...
I think it stopped. Continue, sir. Yeah, no problem.
And then the war came in. Actually, the war started in 1983 in July.
Yeah.
On the 23rd of July in northern Jaffna. And that will be my next post.
Oh, okay. Lovely.
Starting from the next, you know, the first landmine explosion in Sri Lanka. I don't think anyone in Sri Lanka would have heard about landmines.
Right, at that time.
Yes. Because the first landmine explosion took place in Jaffna on the 23rd of July 1983 at 11:20 p.m. When a convoy...
With the soldiers, the army soldiers? Yeah.
When a convoy of soldiers, which was called the 44 Bravo, was returning to Jaffna city, the main camp called Palali, at a place called Tirunelveli.
Wow, sir. That was a lot of information.
Then the convoy consisted of an army truck and a jeep carrying 15 soldiers.
Mm.
And this explosion occurred between the two and caused the instantaneous death of 13 soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the terrorists were firing at these soldiers, and 13 soldiers lost their lives. So that was the first landmine explosion in Sri Lanka at the beginning of this war, which is called the Elam War 1, from 1983 till 1987. And that was a type of terrorist war, guerrilla warfare, where they use hidden tactics, and their weapon of choice was the landmine.
Right.
That is called the hidden enemy, where they bury landmines. No one knows where the landmines are. They will bury it beneath a culvert, or bridges, or on roads, or subways, or on roads leading to the city, or you know, small villages, the attack was on the army as well as civilians.
Right.
To drive away people from certain areas. So actually this first phase of the war from 83 till 87 is called a landmine war.
Right.
So many landmines exploded. Every day when you look at the newspaper, you will find that they will say headlines. Landmine explodes in certain area, 5 dead.
Mm.
Landmine explode, 10 civilians dead. Those were the headlines that we used to see
right.
in the newspaper or on the news.
That's very hard for me to imagine in this day and age.
Yes. But after the first landmine explosion, that was in 83, the eastern province was not so bad at that time.
Mm.
But their aim was to capture both northern and eastern
yes.
provinces. And gradually the violence spread to the eastern province.
That's why you
yeah.
were right.
So I was in Polonnaruwa, just bordering the eastern province. And the problem for the army was that they could not take their casualties to those hospitals in the provinces. That is Ampare, Trincomalee and Batiklo. That was in the eastern region. So they had to take the casualties out of that and bring to the closest hospital was Polonnaruwa Hospital, where I was the surgeon. And that is how I got interested in treating war casualties.
Right.
And that is where when I faced that first explosion, first landmine explosion, which occurred on the 15th of July 1985 in the morning, when I was doing my ward round, 6 casualties were brought in without any notice to my ward.
Right.
And then only I heard about landmine explosions. Of that, 3 were mutilated bodies. 3 were injured and we treated them according to the surgical principles that is used in managing trauma. Then I knew that the war has begun in the eastern province.
Mm.
And then I had to read. Because I told you we have never been
yeah.
taught these subjects in medical school or during my postgraduate studies. Because management of war injuries is quite different to managing any other type of trauma.
Right.
And these principles have been learned during different wars, starting from First World War, Second World War, Vietnam War, you know, different types of war, depending on the type of weapons used. Because you know, there are certain principles that you have to follow.
Mm.
Because most of the weapons that are used are called high energy.
Yeah, yeah. In that post
yeah.
to explain.
High energy means more than 300
it.
Meters per second.
Right.
The speed of that missile or the projectile. And that causes certain changes in the body.
Mm.
And all the wounds are contaminated.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's, you know, some people believe that because when the bullet is ejected from a weapon, because of the heat generated,
mm-hmm.
it is sterile and it has no bacteria. But that is not true.
Not true.
Because all the war wounds are contaminated wounds. And therefore the most important principle is you must do a good excision of damaged tissue. You get a lot of tissue damage because transmission of energy from that high energy bullet to the tissues. So there's a lot of damage. First, secondly, the wounds are contaminated. So you have to remove all the dead and contaminated tissue. And then if the wound is very large, you should not suture it.
Mm.
That is the most important principle in managing war injuries, which is called delayed primary suture. That has been learnt and relearned in many, many wars. So we have to practice that principle. If you don't practice that, what happens when you go and suture a wound, like treating any other wound, you end up with serious infection.
Mm.
And some of them may get tetanus, some of them may get gas gangrene, and that is associated with very high mortality.
Mm.
So these principles we have to learn and practice. So then, because after that first landmine explosion, we were getting more and more casualties. I had to learn that technique.
Yes, sir. When I read it on your post, you said you had to learn all of that,
yes.
Right? And I was thinking, in this modern day and age, we have all these resources. Like, it's just one search away on Google. I was just wondering, how was it in that time to learn something like that? I was like, wow,
that
okay.
Time to learn all those things was very difficult.
Right.
Firstly, because we did not have these mobile phones.
Yeah.
There was no Wi-Fi. Or maybe it was available in other countries, but not in Polonnaruwa.
Mm.
There was no Wi-Fi, there was no internet, there was no computer, there was no mobile phone. I didn't even have a TV at that time. And I had only a fixed phone in my house, the hospital quarters. So whatever I learned was by going to the Sri Lanka Medical Library in Colombo. On my visits to Colombo,
you go there.
I go there and look for articles or journals dealing with war injuries. And I found there are many articles, if anyone wants to read, available. You know, regarding the Second World War, the Korean War, Vietnam War, Northern Ireland, Angola, you know, even today there are so many wars in the many parts of the world.
Right.
So they give us all the details, how we should manage. Then later on, the ICRC, that is the International Committee of the Red Cross, they have teams deployed in war-affected regions to help surgeons in managing these casualties. So they also came here and we had you know, so many symposia, seminars, and then we gradually learned how to do this thing, manage these things. And I was available for these casualties day and night, because I got interested and I had to save the lives of these people fighting for the country. So I was available, and anytime I used to come, but my team was only very small team. So there was only one surgeon who had to manage civilian problems and military problems. Then I had two house officers. There were days I had no anesthetist. Still I did not have a consultant anesthetist. It was only a medical officer in anesthesia. So anyway, the support extended by the staff in the hospital wards and the theatre were tremendous. And the administration and everyone supported. You know, moment they hear the helicopter coming. I was living in a hospital quarters, just adjoining the hospital. Moment a landmine explodes, I get information from the army camp saying that there has been an explosion and they are airlifting some casualties. So we hear the aircraft, you know, helicopter.
Yeah.
Then my team in the hospital also hears this. They know this is the casualties are on the way. Then I rush to the hospital, get the things organized in the ward and the theater. No one grumbled. They came anytime. And the hospital wards were evacuated of the normal patients.
Mm.
Because we didn't know how many are going to come. Everything was ready, you know. One saline bottle hanging to give immediately, like that. So with the support of all the staff, doctors, administration, when I went through my statistics, I found that during July 1985 till 1987, I had treated more than 300 casualties from explosions alone, only from explosions. Out of that, 55% were landmine explosions. And out of that, one-third died. One-third died.
Two-thirds.
Yes. But most of them were completely, you know, mutilated. After landmine explosion, the most gruesome injuries are caused by landmines or bomb explosions. Mutilated bodies. Sometimes you cannot identify. Some are decapitated or, you know, dismembered. Arms and legs are missing. Bowels out. sometimes you can't identify them, you identify only from the tag. You know, they have a number around their neck. They are identified by that. And those, of course, I couldn't help them. They went straight to the mortuary and then they went home in sealed coffins.
Mm.
That is the sad part of the story. And most of those patients, people who went like that in sealed coffins back to their homes were from the villages, the remote villages of Sri Lanka. The most of these boys who came and joined the army are from the remote villages in Sri Lanka, and their parents had to sacrifice their son who died in the war. And it was sad to see these bodies being taken back to their homes. In little, their homes were not mansions. They were real mud huts.
Mm.
And they joined the army. Without their support, I don't think we would have won this war.
Mm.
Because the soldier, the frontline soldier came from the villages of the North Central Province, Southern Province, and all outstation areas. They had to pay the price.
It all sounds so surreal, like especially when I read your posts. You read it, but most of it doesn't go into your head, right? You don't realize like this was something that real that happened. But when I hear it from you, it's
so a lot of people have forgotten these things.
Yeah.
But we must remember those soldiers who sacrificed their lives for the country to eradicate terrorism. That is something we should not forget. Not only them, even their parents who send their children to the war front.
Mm.
So actually I got interested in this because I went to Polonnaruwa.
Mm.
If I didn't go to Polonnaruwa, I would not have got this experience. Experience is something that you get by practicing,
right,
not by reading books.
Yeah.
So what I did was, I was exposed to certain things which I had never seen nor managed.
Or even heard of.
Heard of. Then, when these casualties came, I had to read about it and learn. Learned and relearned.
Mm.
And then practice those principles according to accepted principles of managing war casualties. Then I gathered knowledge. Then I shared my knowledge with others in the form of lectures, presentations, by publications, by orations, locally plus overseas.
And now blog posts.
Yes, and now I am sharing my knowledge because I don't want it to go waste.
Right.
So I want to share my knowledge, whatever knowledge that I have gathered over this period of 38 years as a surgeon, with others, maybe the younger generation who want to become surgeons in the future, or doctors, or even others. It is knowledge.
Right.
So what I'm doing now is sharing my knowledge as well as educating people. So actually there's a very good response for my blog post. So I'm very happy about it. So I will continue to write, hoping to write at least once a week a story.
That's lovely, because even my batchmates are telling me, like, showing me that they're reading it and that they're very interested.
Lot of people have sent their comments, and they are very good comments, thanking me for giving them this knowledge, which they cannot get by from textbooks.
Yeah, definitely, sir, because even the most recent one, I could have never imagined that what you said about the injuries, the mechanism behind it.
Yeah.
I was mind blown.
Yeah, so all that is something that I am telling the people, but something I had to learn on my own.
Yeah.
Now what I have learned, it's useless for me to keep it to myself, because I want to disseminate that knowledge to the younger generation. So it's material freely available, no charge. Those who want to read and learn can read. Those who don't want to read, I can't help them.
Right. Simply put.
Simply. And I want to illustrate these with pictures.
Right.
Without the photographs,
you don't get a feel for it.
It's just reading, I think, is useless. You must, you know, some people say this Dr. Gunatilak is showing photographs which are not good. But those articles have to be illustrated with photographs of those types of injuries.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no point.
Right.
So, that's why I always mention caution.
Right.
Those who don't
yeah.
want to look at these photographs can, you know, cover their eyes and go through that page, go to the next page. But there are others who want to know what type of injury.
Definitely.
If I was learning, I would have want to know if landmines explode, what are the, how do they come? You cannot describe that in words.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I, you know, I had an exhibition and of all...
I think I came for that. I was very small.
The purpose of that exhibition was to demonstrate by photographs.
Yeah.
Because I know my students that whom I have taught medical students, I think for more than 25 years, maybe about 30 years. Some of those students are consultants now, and they, when they meet me, they tell me, sir, we still remember the photographs that you showed us. So that is the importance of photographs. And photograph is worth 1,000 words. What I describe to you, if I show a photograph, it will remain in your memory forever. What I'm talking to you now, you might forget. But if I show you a photograph, that will remain in your memory forever. Especially this type of injuries.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important to, you know, add some photographs to your story. Some may not like it, but I think I have to do it. You know, otherwise, whatever you want to read, you can read from a textbook which doesn't carry so many photographs. They will have some diagrams, line diagrams. That doesn't mean anything.
The photos give the reality of
it. Yes, you must. Now, I will be demonstrating more and more of this in the future. So, it's education. That's why I. Actually, I had this idea. First of all, I published a book, and the title of the book is In the Line of Duty. And I described that book actually came out after 25 years of my service as a surgeon. And that book has a lot of illustrations, color photographs. Then I went into 4 editions of that book. Then I was wondering, now all the books are sold out. Whether I should go for another edition or do something different. So I thought of starting this website. And, you know, writing this, what I had in my book, in story form. Because I felt that people are more interested in reading that type of thing related to people's day-to-day problems. And I think people appreciate it now. When I look at the stats for my site, I can see that it has been circulated to almost every part of the globe.
Right.
And so many people are looking at it, so it has a wider coverage. You know, publishing a book is a difficult task.
Yeah.
You know, you have to go to the printer, you have to do proofreading, you have to set the photographs, then next thing you have to sell the book. Selling the book is another task. You leave it at the bookshop, no one will advertise your book.
Yeah.
When you give the book to the bookshop, they will want a commission. After my doing all the hard work.
Yeah.
So, actually it's more simple, but only thing I had to spend some time writing the story and putting the photographs in the correct place. But I feel now it's fully worth.
And this is all freely available for anyone.
Freely available, you just go to Google and type gaminigunatilaka.wordpress, you go to my site.
Yeah.
And now I started a photo gallery.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you saw that.
I don't think I did.
It starts with my life, from my small days.
Okay. Okay, that's what I'll be checking out tonight.
That's called my photo gallery. It starts with my early life. No, my with photographs of my parents and when I was very small.
Mm.
And how I gradually went to St. Joseph's College. And then next part was going to the Faculty of Medicine, Colombo. What I did there, then my sports activities. In the faculty, I did a lot of sporting activities. Not rowing.
I'm always associated with that.
We also had a team.
Rowing team? Yeah, that time, definitely. University of Colombo, right?
Yes.
But
I played rugby. I played cricket, I played hockey, I played football.
Wow.
And I also played rugby for my school as well as for the club. So after I joined university, I had to play for the university. And I captained the university rugby team as well as the combined university rugby team. That time we had only two universities, faculties of medicine, one in Colombo, one in Kandy.
Right.
So after the season, we have a combined team, which play in another tournament. So I captained that team as well. So
all this while learning medicine.
I think when you're studying medicine or any subject, you must have some other activity as well. You can't be studying the whole day. I used to spend every evening in the university grounds. Every evening.
Mm.
Even maybe one day before the exam. Because I think recreation is very important, or sporting activity. And I used to, I was living down the same lane. My parents' house was, this is number 22. My parents' house down that road, which is called Suleiman Avenue, number 12. And I used to go to St. Joseph's College by bus, some days by cycle. Because there wasn't much traffic.
Right, those days.
And from my home to St. Joseph's College, it cost me only 10 cents.
Wow.
If I go near town hall, it is only 5 cents.
That's crazy. Right.
And the pocket money I got was 25 cents.
25 cents?
Yes. And we had an interval, which is called the short interval, for 15 minutes.
Mm.
During that time, we had two tuck shops.
Mm.
I don't know whether you have that now.
They have
some things, items prepared in the college itself,
not brought
from home.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had what is called sambolapan.
Mm, yes.
That is like a sandwich with onion sambol.
That's of course the best.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they give a glass of lime juice, not a small glass, a very big glass, which is 5 cents. So that is how we had a short interval, then we had a lunch interval. School starts at 9:30, we finish at 3:30.
9:30, 3:30.
Yeah. With a short interval at 10:15 till 10:30. Another one from 12 to 1 o'clock, lunch interval, where we have our lunch in school. So we finish lunch early and we play games like cricket during that interval.
Mm.
Then after school we come home, there was no private tuition. Today after school or before school, everyone rushes to private tuition.
Yeah.
And I think the children are under utter stress. And they have too many exams, scholarship exam, this exam, that exam. He had only two exams, the O level and the A level. And there was no tension. And the requirement was only to get 5 credits. Today everyone wants to get, I don't know, 8 A's. Distinctions or A's. Otherwise some of them get depressed and commit suicide.
Yeah. That's very interesting to hear that it was like that back in the day. But these
days it's the same. You sit for the O level, you get 5 credits, you go to the next grade, which is the A level.
Yeah.
And there are only two universities, Colombo and Peradeniya. There was no ESET score, district quota, nothing. You are selected to medical school on merit.
Mm.
Merit means your results at the A level exam. That is the only thing that is considered. When you come from Munaragana, Mahiyangana, Jaffna, Norelio, any place. So the, my batch had 150 medical students. But I am sorry to say, out of that 150, only 40 are remaining in Sri Lanka. Others have left the country. So out of that year, they took 150 to Colombo, 75 to Peradeniya. So that is how selection was made to medical school at that time. There was no cut-off point and ESET scores and district quota and all these things. The best 150 from A-level results entered medical school. That's all. No complaints to anyone, nothing. And that is confirmed. And you go and do your medical studies, there are no strikes. We don't waste time. Actually, I finished my medical career course in 4 years and 9 months.
Wow.
At the end of that period, maybe I think I finished my exam in August. By October, I started my internship. On the 14th of October, I finished my internship. The next day itself, I started my post-intern appointment. And the appointment is given again on merit. We apply, the letter comes to your home, a letter by the Ministry of Health saying that my next appointment is this hospital, which was Colombo South Teaching Hospital at Kalubovili. We just take that letter, go to the hospital, report by giving it to the, at that time they were not director, they were called medical superintendent.
Okay.
Give the letter, start work, no waste of time. And there are no functions to say, you know, today when doctors are appointed, there are big functions in certain places where all the doctors are invited, parents are invited, politicians give letters of appointment showing that they are giving jobs. But these things happened many years ago.
Right. Things are so different now.
So we didn't waste time waiting for even... After the A-level, we did not waste time. During medical school, we didn't waste time. After qualifying, we didn't waste time. After doing the internship, immediately after that, we start the second, or the post-intern appointment. That is how everything functions smoothly. But now, I find that everything is in a mess.
Yeah, definitely.
Whether it's local medical student or overseas medical student, everything seems to be in utter mess. When it should have been in a better position, with, you know, we have so much of facilities now, all what do you call online.
Right.
So the medical Ministry of Health should have a computer-based system.
Yeah. Because I went to SLMC to get work done.
Right. Because I think they have to get rid of the files and have a.
Yeah.
The website.
It's the future, you need to give way to the future.
It should be digitalized. And it's so simple, no?
Right.
What's the difficulty? That is how it should go. And then you can apply for your appointment online. They select, you get the appointment by email, you go with that, that email, present it and do it. So these ideas should be put to the different departments. This is a difficult thing in Sri Lanka. For people with ideas to hand it, give it to someone.
Right.
You need to have some connection somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't have those connections. But I have a lot of ideas based on my experience. Of 38 years working as a surgeon in this country from 1982. People don't want to make use of my experience. What can I do? I don't want to go behind anyone and say I can suggest these things. Because I have realized that you cannot suggest things by force to people. If they ask me, what are your suggestions for this, I can recommend. I have done this before. You know, I have made recommendations in writing, by speaking to people, nothing has worked. then only I realized that my giving suggestions to people doesn't work. If they ask for my suggestions, how can we improve the service in this hospital or trauma service, I can. There are so many things that can be done.
Yeah.
In my lectures, I have designed the trauma program for Sri Lanka. It is all published. It is documented. It will come online very soon.
Right.
And why I did that was, when I studied this, starting from these war injuries, then in Polonnaruwa we had a lot of patients coming after agricultural accidents.
Mm.
Then when I came to other places, I saw there were a lot of patients coming from other forms of trauma, like, you know, stab injuries, cut injuries. Then came road traffic accidents. These are all causing added burden to our economy.
Mm.
Because we have free medical care.
Right.
These patients who are injured in any type of trauma, maybe road accident, maybe stabbed by someone after alcohol, assaulted, or agricultural accidents affecting farmers. All these patients come to the government hospital. Most of them come, 90% or more come attend the government hospital, and they get free treatment. And who has to bear the burden? The country has to bear the burden of giving free medication and hospital facilities, which comes to billions of rupees per year. And when I went through the annual report of the Ministry of Health, if you look at that, they classify the admissions to government hospitals. Because I did some studies on trauma in Sri Lanka, I find that the commonest cause of admission to hospitals in Sri Lanka since 1995 is trauma.
Mm.
And then I thought this is because of the war. But if you go and look at the statistics today, even after the war ended in 2009, 11 years ago, still the commonest cause of admission to hospital is trauma. So we must have a better system of managing trauma. So I have devised a certain scheme, which is called my trauma control program. How we can reduce this incident by so many aspects. You know, first of all, we must have a database. Without that you cannot do anything. That means, you know, like any other communicable disease. Now, Sri Lanka had epidemic of malaria, right? We had epidemics of other smallpox, polio, other communicable diseases like diphtheria, tetanus. For all these, especially malaria. If you take malaria, we had what is called the malaria control program. Right, and there's a headquarters, there's staff, and they decide how we should eradicate malaria. There is a scheme. Now Sri Lanka is free of malaria.
Yeah.
Whatever we get is from other countries.
Right.
So it was, first of all, it's a notifiable disease. Right. Now, when I was working in Polonnaruwa, there was a very high incidence of malaria.
Mm.
And some of them had Plasmodium falciparum, that is cerebral malaria, which affects the brain, and you can die. That's a different type of malaria. So a lot of farmers died. We had epidemic in the 1930s, where I think the entire Polonnaruwa district was eradicated. But because of a certain program, called the Malaria Eradication Program or Malaria Control Program, they have come to control this epidemic. So similarly for trauma, I suggested the Trauma Control Program. Yes, we must have a separate headquarters. So first of all, we must have a database. That means trauma should be made a notifiable disease. Right? Supposing a patient is admitted to any hospital, say after road traffic accident or gunshot or stabbed or assaulted or fall, that must be notified to a we have got regional districts, regional, what I call regional health authorities. So anyone, there must be a form. You fill that form, notify that region, the director of that region. At the end of the year, you can have a data. What are the causes of trauma in this district?
Right.
Then you have from all the regions coming to the main head office. Then we know exactly what are the causes of trauma for the whole country.
Yeah.
What is causing this problem? Is it road accidents or is it agricultural accidents? What is the age group that is affected? What is the, you know, result of these accidents? Are they getting disabled? Or, you know, the economic impact of this?
Then each of those would have a separate solution.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is the most important thing? The economic impact of the cost of treatment of these patients in hospital, number one. Then their loss of employment. Some are disabled. Now I saw many patients in Polonnaruwa getting injured by trap guns. I have recorded that in my stories. Some of them end up in amputation. Then they cannot work as a farmer anymore.
Right.
So he becomes a social problem.
Right.
He cannot, you know, maintain his family. So some of them go begging. Or they depend on the government program for help. Then the cost of maintaining them in hospital. Then comes insurance problems. Trauma means road traffic accident, insurance claims.
Mm.
Then you have to have rehabilitation facilities. You need psychological assessment and psychological rehabilitation. All this is needed to finally bring him back to society.
Mm.
Now if you have a patient, say, we had problems during the war, mine injuries, antipersonal mine injuries, where most of them ended up in amputations. Now they had to be supplied with artificial limbs so that they can walk again. They must be found alternate employment. Then they need to be rehabilitated. You need good facilities for rehabilitation. Just giving the artificial limb and telling him to go home is not the care. No? You must train him how to use that artificial limb. Then they are psychologically affected after trauma. So you need psychological rehabilitation. You need a lot of psychologists. Now, my daughter actually is doing psychologist.
Yeah.
And she's doing another field called art therapy.
Yeah.
It is art psychotherapy, which is also useful for this type of people.
Mm.
In addition to other uses of art psychotherapy, which I am not an expert, so when people ask, I tell them to ask her. That's not my field. But I know that has a place in this type of people, especially children.
Mm.
Say, the father dies in accident. The family is going to suffer.
Mm.
The children are going to suffer. This has been incorporated into one program called the Trauma Control Program, starting from notification, pre-hospital care, hospital care, first aid, paramedics, ambulance service, then trauma teams. What should be done? And the other thing is, in other Western countries, they have what is called trauma protocol. Say, patient is admitted with a head injury. You learn when you start your medical career. Right? Patient is admitted after a road traffic accident, he is unconscious. He is admitted to hospital emergency department. They have what is called trauma protocol.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the director of the hospital will find out whether this patient has been managed according to those protocol. Especially if, you know, he gets complications. From the time of admission up to the time of recovery, or if he gets complication, they will check.
Mm.
There's a certain form that has to be filled. On admission, this is the condition, you know, the Glasgow coma scale and things like that. And then you have to follow that program, that protocol. If you don't follow the protocol, then patient get develop symptom that doctor is responsible for not following the protocol. That is how it works in other countries, especially England. I know because I worked in England. And if you don't follow those protocol, if patient gets complication, you can be charged by the medical council and you might lose your job. So these things have to come into Sri Lanka.
It's stuck in the past. These ideas, you should, like, for example, me, I understood what you said, even at my level. I think you should pass it on to the younger generation.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying
to do. That's what you're trying to do.
I'm trying to do my best for the younger generation, you know.
Yeah, let me tell you, it's working.
So I want to publish as much as possible.
Yeah.
Maybe once a week, sometime, if I have time, maybe twice a week. All these things I want to put it on.
Yeah.
Online.
Even this, like how you feel like you could improve.
Yes. The
Definitely.
Problem is, you know, the local system is politicized.
Right.
That's the biggest problem in this country. Everything is politicized. You cannot get your ideas across unless you have good political connection.
Right.
I don't think it should be like that. You know, I'm not a politician. It's up to me at the election to decide on which party I'm going to support or vote. But my ideas are for my people and my country,
right.
Not for anyone else. So if they don't want to take ideas and, you know, advice or ideas based on experience, not by reading books, we cannot apply what is practiced in other countries to Sri Lanka, no? We must have our own system. For that, you have to have a person who will advise depending on his experience, what he has seen.
Yeah.
I have seen from the rural areas to semi-urban to urban. So I know the difficulties of people, I know the difficulties in the hospitals, I know the difficulties faced by surgeons. There are problems. So even if you want to improve the health service, today it's not done on a regional basis. The politician will say, this is the priority for me is to improve this hospital only.
Right.
I don't want to mention names, but over the past I know certain hospitals, certain ministers spent all the money, billions of rupees, on the improving hospital in his area. It has happened for the last 30 years. But I think that is the wrong system. Now we have got 9 provinces, right? Some 25 districts. So our management of patients should be orientated in that manner. Now what is happening to our patients today? Still I am getting patients coming from distant areas.
Right.
Sometimes from Polonnaruwa, sometimes Anuradhapura, sometimes Ambittipitiya, sometimes even further away, Ampal. Why? For some small condition.
Yeah, they come all the way
here. So that is wrong. That's because
we
have no system. Now in England, there's called the National Health Service and there's a system.
Right.
You cannot go and, if you are, say, living in the district of Surrey, you cannot go and take treatment in Liverpool.
Yeah.
You have to go and meet your GP.
Yes, hearing it like that sounds so insane, but it's what happens here on a daily basis.
You must go and meet your GP. The GP will have a file for you. Right? You have to get an appointment. If it's an emergency, you go straight to the emergency department. Then the GP will get an appointment for you at the local hospital, you know, depending on your problem. But here what is happening?
Yeah.
The patient is going from one doctor to another doctor. And that is called doctor shopping.
Yeah, I've heard of that, yes.
That also I have written in my stories.
Yeah.
So they go to one doctor. That doctor orders so many investigation treatment. Then they show that prescription to another doctor. He orders some more investigations. Then it goes on like that. And finally, the ignorant people, they would have seen many doctors finally they till they reach that doctor who will care for them. And when they come for a consultation, they come carrying a bag advertising a hospital, and inside that bag is so many documents, you know, reports, x-rays, CT scans, sometimes MRI scans. And when they come to the consult, what do they do? When I went to medical college, I learned a system of treating a patient.
Okay.
First of all, you talk to the patient and take a history. That is called a history of the illness. You know, starting from your name, ahanawa kohada inne, mokadda rassawa, kawule kiyadenek innawada, like that, kawadada ledde patan gatte. That is called the history of the illness. Then you also ask a few questions about the family background, social history, any smoking, alcohol habit, all that, past medical history, any drugs you are taking. Drugs means medicines. Then you come to the second stage, examination. That is what you have to follow. You know, examination comes, starts with general examination of the body. Because if you do general examination, you will find so many signs that will direct you towards a certain illness. Then you examine the system by system. Cardiovascular, respiratory, abdominal system, nervous system, musculoskeletal system. Right? If you do it like that, sometimes you can get a tentative diagnosis. Or you have a differential diagnosis. Then based on that, you do what is called the relevant investigations. Relevant.
Yeah, relevant.
Not all the investigations that you have in the book. Today it's not happening that way.
Really?
So you do what is called relevant. Maybe the basic blood test, urine test, chest x-ray, ECG. Those are the basic ones. After that you go for, you know, advanced test, still if you have not found the condition. Maybe CT scan, then MRI scan. Then you can, depending on the system, angiography. Like that, then endoscopy. So it must be based on the patient's, you know, history and examination, directed towards finding the cause. And then you find the cause, give appropriate treatment. As a surgeon, I must tell you, every patient who comes to me is not operated on.
Yeah, you need to know.
Yeah. No, not only that. First of all, people think that surgeon means he is cutting everyone who comes.
Right.
This I tell my students. I would have told your mother as well. First thing is, there's a thing called reassurance. There are so many patients who come even today. You know, sometimes they may come with a pain in the breast, or they think that they have a breast lump and they think it is cancer. Someone has put it into their head that they are having cancer. Or they will come and say, "Magi, gedara yaha patthek kenata mehema amaruwak thibuna ya pilikawak hedla meruna. Magi ammata pilikawak thibuna." That doesn't mean that you are also having cancer. So you have examined it and reassure that you don't have a lump and you have no cancer. There's no need to do, you know, other tests like needle punctures and mammograms and all these things straight away. You reassure that you are not having a serious problem. Then if you talk to the patient, patient is happy, they will. I say, come back in 6 months and see me again. You don't need any investigations or treatment. But in Sri Lanka, our people are used to investigations, multiple medicines.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do that, they say, this mein doctor maathe honda ne.
Right.
Mein doctor maathe behe pukakka thunne. Api yana yana doctor maathe. That doctor will say, nah, nah, make a look at prasnya. Adam aprenya kiranu. That what happens. So anyway, that's up to each person's conscience. So you have to follow the certain system. Then the second, first is reassurance. Then there are so many conditions. Patient comes to a surgeon, but you can treat by medicines. Right? You don't have to do operation. The third one is where you have to do operation. And that some of them will need emergency surgery. Like someone coming after road traffic accident, he has bleeding into his abdomen, like ruptured liver or spleen. You cannot keep him till tomorrow. You have to operate immediately. You may have to give blood transfusion, resuscitate and operate. There are others you don't have to operate immediately. You give because of your so many patients, you have a waiting list. So say like uncomplicated hernia, uncomplicated goiter, you have to have a waiting list. Not a long waiting list, depending on the number of patients. You tell them, come and get admitted on a certain day, and you do the operation. So, rushing for operations is a serious matter. I don't think you should rush for operations. Everyone gets excited. Patient gets excited. Family members get excited. And psychologically they are affected. And another thing is also documented in medical journals. You must never operate late in the night, unless it is a very serious life-threatening problem. Not 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock is not the time to do your routine operations. It is documented. Why?
More chance of error?
Yeah, more chance of error because the surgeon is sleepy. The anesthetist is sleepy. Your assistant is sleepy. That is the time to sleep.
Yeah.
That is the time to sleep, not to operate. You fix up a time during daytime. But if you get a call at 1 o'clock, I have got many calls at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock.
That's just how it is.
I have done an operation in the morning. Patient develops a complication, say.
Yeah.
I have done an operation on the belly, abdomen. Patient has a problem. One of my sutures has slipped. He's bleeding inside. And I get a call saying the patient is pale, patient's blood pressure is falling, and patient is, the pulse is very weak and rapid. That means I know that this patient is bleeding. Now I cannot keep that patient till tomorrow. I have to go and do what I can. And I have done that many times. So surgeon should be available for emergencies, especially for his emergencies if he has operated. If he has operated on a patient, he must be available to tackle the emergency. Because every surgeon has complications. You may be the best surgeon in the world, but still you have complications. These are things I have learned. No surgeon can say, I have not had any complications. What does it mean if he says that?
Not enough surgeries done.
No. That means he's not operating, yeah. He's not operating or not doing enough surgery.
Yeah. No? Complication yet to come.
Yes. So, I say always, I have even given lectures on my complications.
Right.
So that others will learn. Because any surgeon has complications, we must be available. And we must give that message to the junior doctors. That these are the possible things that can happen. So look out for these things in your night round. And if you have any problem, please call me. If you don't call me and the patient dies, you have to take the responsibility. But if you call me and I don't come, I have to take the responsibility. And I also tell them, write on the bed death ticket. If you examine the patient, write on the bed death ticket. These are your findings. If you call me, write 8:30 p.m. I called the surgeon and told the condition. And surgeon gave certain instructions. Surgeon said he will come, but he did not come.
It's all recorded.
It's recorded. Because in medical legal practice, the only document that is accepted by courts is the bed death ticket. That is why I have told my junior house officers, maintain proper records. If you don't have records and something happens, you have to be responsible, not me. So these are things that I can tell the junior doctors provided that I get opportunity.
Mm.
If I don't get opportunity, what can I do? I can only write stories.
This would be a lovely thing to talk about in a podcast, don't you think? Like these little advices you
yes.
can give, like little
yeah,
segments.
Little advices, very good
yeah.
idea.
So you definitely should.
So I think very lot of people might listen to this.
Yeah, because I personally know so many people at school itself who are interested in medicine. And then there's 60 odd people in my batch and they're interested in the stories. Imagine the advice. How much
value it has. I am very keen to give this advice
mm-hmm.
to anyone who is interested.
Right.
Not
and
to those
yeah.
who are not interested.
Right.
Because some of them think they know everything. But I still say that I have some more to learn.
Yeah.
Every time I talk to someone or I see a patient, sometimes when I come back home, I think to myself whether I have done the correct treatment for this patient.
Mm-hmm.
Works in your mind. Sometimes a patient dies, then you think, I have had sleepless nights.
Nice.
Because I find that it works on your mind whether I could have saved this patient's life by doing something different. You know, these are all human aspects.
Nice.
We are treating human beings. So
you never stop learning.
We have to keep on learning and improve ourselves. Starting from the very first day you join medical school, you must read, you must listen to people with experience, talk to them, read their stories when possible.
Especially if they are all available.
Yes, they are all available freely. You don't have to pay a cent. When you have time, read my stories.
Or listen to one of your podcasts.
Yes, yes. Or listen to one of my podcasts. With Netmini. You learn a lot about my experiences. I think it is experiences that matter, not reading books. What you learn from an experienced person is what he has to tell about his experience in hospitals in this country.
And you can never get that from
a
book.
You cannot get that from a book. No one has written about experiences in Sri Lanka in any textbook in this country. No book. That's why I wrote my book, titled In the Line of Duty. What I have done, starting from my very small days, going to school, all that, you know, and then going to England to qualify, coming back, various hospitals, what
other
things.
Mommy had that, but I think she gave it to a relative. I've been trying to find it.
I will give you a copy today.
Really?
Yes.
Lovely, thank you.
And then, I was told that many people read this book in Sinhala. So I got it translated to Sinhala and it is called Yutukama Perata. Your duty comes first. So it was translated by one of my patients, free of charge. I had only to print it. And the problem is all these books have been sold out.
It's all sold out, yeah.
So that is why I thought of writing more stories. You know, some of them are already in my book. But I am now expanding the story because in a book you cannot put all these.
Right.
So I take one topic and think about it and then I look for my photographs because I have a whole collection of photographs which I have taken in Polon Nadu, in Gampaha, in the war front, in Javadnapura, wherever I went, sometimes on the road I have taken photographs of accidents.
Maybe you could publish it as a e-book or something. I wonder how that would work. When the people who are interested.
Yeah.
Because I was so interested. I was so sad. We went to Sarasavi or somewhere and I couldn't find it. I was like, Ammi, why did you give it away?
No.
I was so annoyed.
Don't worry, I will give you a book.
Thank you. That I'm actually really happy about it.
Mm. So that's... But I think that book is called In the Life of Line
In
of
the
Duty.
Line of Duty.
The life and times of a surgeon in war and peace. Because I have worked in times of war and times of peace. So I told you earlier, the practice is different. When you encounter war casualties and when you encounter civilian casualties.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of both together with other experiences. I have given my experiences of going to the war front. Because at that time there was a serious issue of lack of surgeons. So some civilian surgeons decided to overcome this problem by visiting the war front. That is, you know, the war front, actually northern war front, which is Jaffna. And there was a small hospital called the Palali Base Hospital, where we used to take turns and go by aircraft at a risk. Because the terrorists were firing at these planes, and so many planes were brought down, and so many died. So it was a risk. So all these have been documented in my book, how we went to Palali, how we returned, the planes that we went on. I'm not going to tell you all these stories now.
I'm going to read it all.
Because I will be publishing all this in my website. How I went to Palali, what casualties I treated, how I brought them back to Colombo. There is also another chapter in my book, which also will be a part of my stories. How I went to Jaffna. How I went to Jaffna means how I went to the city of Jaffna, which was controlled by terrorists. Some people thought I am a supporter of terrorism. But I went there for a purpose. And I was the only first single doctor to go there during
that
time of war.
That you wrote, right, in one of your blog posts? The one with the girl, I don't remember her name, who was a terrorist. I remember that.
Yeah.
Ami was telling me the rest
more
of the
detail,
story.
Things will come. Actually, I went to Jaffna not to support terrorism.
Right.
I went to Jaffna for a purpose. And that purpose, if I did not go, the medical students there would not have had their final MBBS exam in 1994.
Right.
I went to Jaffna in 1994 November. That is 26 years ago. Because there was a faculty of medicine in Jaffna. There were no teachers. There was one surgeon in the hospital. And he invited me to Jaffna as an external examiner. And he told me, don't worry, Kamini, you don't have to worry. If you come to Jaffna, that means you are coming with certain person's permission.
Right.
You will not be harmed. So I went to Jaffna, I was one of the examiners. The first examiner from Sri Lanka, Colombo, or the south to go to Jaffna to conduct the exam. For the Jaffna medical students in 1994. And the way how I went to Jaffna, what problems I had coming back, I'm not going to tell you now.
Yes, leave me in suspense.
Yeah, that is history. And when I arrived in Jaffna, there were certain people to meet me. And I was treated like a VIP. So all these will form another story. I must tell you, I have experiences which most of the others don't have.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I thought that I must do whatever I can, whether it is in Pulonnaruwa, whether it is in Jaffna, if I was called for a certain purpose, I will go. And I think I had no problem. Because I was doing a service. And I have been called for that service by someone, God Almighty. That is what I believe in. So I wish you all the best in your podcasting, and I hope I can have more chats with you.
Oh, definitely.
So that I can convey my experiences to those who are interested in doing medicine, those who are interested in being doctors, or especially surgeons. Because for us, it is the patient that matters, not anything else. So you have to follow certain principles. And I hope this message will go around and more and more people will listen to this podcasting and also look at my site
on
kaminigunatilaka.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
where I have written so many stories, I think about 25 now. Starting from my days in Polonnaruwa. So these are freely available for people to read at leisure. How I started as a surgeon, how I progressed, how I learned, and how I gave my knowledge to others, medical students, junior doctors, surgical trainees, most of them are as working as consultants, locally as well as overseas. So I am happy that I have done my service, but I have not completed my service.
Not yet.
So I want to educate more and inspire more to do better than what I have done. Thank you very much for this podcast.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. All right.
Yeah. How long have you gone?